Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Peter Biskind, whose latest book is Down and Dirty Pictures, Miramax, Sundance, and the Rise of Independent Film, author of a book that has now become a classic, Easy Rider's Raging Bulls, How the Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll Generation Saved Hollywood, basically a history of 1970s Hollywood, probably the greatest decade in Hollywood from many people's perspective since the 1930s. And would you agree with that assessment?
I would definitely agree with that assessment. There is a little bit of backlash. If you say the sky is blue long enough, someone's going to come along and say, no, the sky is pink. But, yes, I think that's absolutely right. I don't think we're ever going to see another 1970s again.
When you're working on a book like that, and let's talk about that before we get to your new one, how do you know what to choose? You can't put everything in.
Well, the 70s book I organized around, quote-unquote, auteurs, you know, the great. Each chapter was devoted to one of the major filmmakers. That did mean leaving out some great films that were not made by filmmakers that had a sort of a consistent record. That was the organizing principle. It went from, you know, Scorsese to Coppola to, you know, right, Lucas, yeah, to Spielberg, et cetera, et cetera. I also tried to do something which is not all that often done in film books, although I don't know why, because it's kind of obvious. But film books usually seem to break down either into business books, sort of tabloid gossip star biographies, or aesthetic appreciations, hagiographies of an individual director. And, you know, the film business being what it is, as famously the tug of war between art and commerce, it's all of those things. So I try to achieve a balance between an appreciation of the films themselves, a lot of information about people's lives, you know, how they lived. I mean, the concept of the book is really not so much the films of the 70s, but what life was like for these people making those films in Hollywood throughout that decade. And then I also tried to deal with the business end of it, how the films changed over the decade, because it's often the business and the economics of the industry that ultimately dictate what kind of films we see. And I think if you don't deal with that, you're not really doing film history a service.
Except for the organizing principle, which is a little bit different. You're dealing with the same themes here, which brings up a broader question, which I was going to ask you later on, but let's start from here, which is the difference between reporting, gossip, telling a good story, fiction and nonfiction. And let me throw out, as I talk about that, not merely Easy Rider's Raging Bulls, which is kind of not that many years later has turned into a classic in the field, but also earlier works like, of course, Lillian Ross's book Picture, as well as Truman Capote's In Cold Blood.
Well, you know, it is an interesting question. Some of the reviews of this book, Down and Dirty Pictures, described it in a more or less invidious way as full of gossip. And I'm actually a little sensitive to that, and I actually looked up the dictionary definition of gossip, and the dictionary said something like idle talk and ill-founded rumor. And as somebody who spent almost a month putting together, you know, 30 or 40 pages of small type footnotes, and every single quote in the book is sourced, it's anything but gossip. And where things were actually rumored, I said in the book that X was rumored to have said or is supposed to have said. I was very careful not to present gossip as fact. And the things that are sourced are, in fact, things that people said. Now, there's obviously many, you know, different versions of any given incident. I mean, there is a sort of Rashomon effect. And you have to try to interview more than one person on any, you know, crucial event. For example, in Down and Dirty Pictures, one important occurrence was was when Miramax tried to buy back The Crying Game from the investors in England. And there were a lot of people at the table, and that was a very important moment for Miramax, because by doing that, they made sure that they made a lot more money on the film than they would have had they just gotten a distribution fee. And, you know, there are many, many different versions of how that sale went down. Well, I had to try to find as many people who were involved with that as possible and interview all of them. I mean, many times during the, you know, in the course of writing the book, I thought, yes, it would be a lot easier to be writing fiction, you know, and envy fiction writers. But, you know, ultimately, in both these books, in some sense, fact is stranger than fiction, and I don't think I could have, you know, had I made it up, I don't think it could have been, you know, some of these stories could have been any more bizarre.
We hear the phrase lying liars to discuss pundits and to discuss Washington politicians, particularly Republicans. But that could easily describe most of the people or many of the people in Hollywood. When you're dealing with liars and spinmeisters, how do you discern, particularly when you receive five different Rashomon views of the same story? You can't just keep going one after the other after the other.
No, that's true. Well, you know, you have to make a kind of a judgment call over, you know, about which of your sources has the most agendas going, what self-interest is served by what version of the story, and the general veracity of the source. And, you know, once you get to, you know, you always come back and interview the same people over and over again, not always, but often. And once you get a little bit of familiarity with the source, it's not that hard to sort of figure out, I think, who tends to be more voracious and who less so.
The central actor in this book, it appears that you wanted the central actors to be Redford and Harvey Weinstein, but Redford refused to talk to you. But Weinstein is the central character of this book, and he is an absolute monster, or seems to come across that way. As you're writing it, did you get afraid that as you told the true story of this man? I mean, he's larger than life, sure, but still, he's a monster, to a point where when I talked to Ken Auletta and asked him who he'd rather hang out with, Roger Ailes or Weinstein, he said, Roger Ailes.
That's a good question. Well, you know, for one thing, it's oddly enough, I don't consider him a monster, and I actually don't consider that he comes, I don't think he comes off as a monster in the book, although obviously you disagree. Sometimes you don't, you sort of lose the thread about how people come off in the book. But I have had people tell me that I was too nice to him. My intention is not, if you can, I can at all help it, to portray people as monsters, because it, to me, it suggests a sort of black and white Manichaean view of the world. You know, most people have a bit of good and a bit of bad, and I try to present them as complex characters. Harvey, for example, has a wonderful sense of humor. He can be extremely charming, and he actually arguably did a lot of good for independent films. I mean, I probably wouldn't have written the book were it not for Miramax and were it not for Harvey and Bob. That being said, he has done a lot of things that I suppose might be characterized as monstrous. But I, you know, I actually don't see him that way. People are very ambivalent about Miramax. I mean, I guess the most characteristic response is a love-hate relationship. They love what Harvey stands for, but they hate the way he conducts his business. You know, you'll hear things like Harvey will, everybody else in Hollywood will stab you in the back, Harvey will stab you in the stomach. You know, he's very out front. He wears his heart on his sleeve. I mean, in Hollywood, you never hear no, even when the intention is no. Harvey will say no right off the bat, or he'll say yes. He moves decisively. I mean, one of the worst things about working in Hollywood is people string you along. I mean, that's Redford's MO, and that can drive you crazy. If Harvey wants to do something, he'll say yes. If he doesn't want to do it, he'll say no. And that's not entirely true. You do hear stories about him diddling people along or changing his mind. He can treat people shabbily. There's no question about it. But there is a forthrightness to Harvey that I think plays very well there.
Is it true that the reason that Cold Mountain did not get the Oscar nomination for Best Picture is because people resent Harvey Weinstein, you think?
Well, I mean, I don't know that that's true. I mean, I think that's certainly one of the theories, and that's certainly a plausible theory. I mean, I think the film was easily as good as any of the films that were nominated. On the other hand, Harvey's not well-liked in Hollywood. You know, there's now apparently an internet campaign attacking the film and attacking Miramax for shooting it, which is, after all, about quintessentially American story in Romania. And there's another internet campaign about the way the film treats or doesn't treat slavery. So there are a lot of bones being picked with the film. At the same time, you know, Harvey, and the Romania thing is particularly galling in the sense that Harvey shamelessly used 9/11 to suggest that the Oscars be moved to New York. You know, so on the one hand, he's like boosting New York and using 9/11 as, you know, excuse, and then shooting the film in Romania. And at the same time, I think people have not forgotten Harvey, Shakespeare in Love, Harvey collecting the Best Picture Oscar for Shakespeare in Love in 1998. In this case, he took executive producer credit, so he would not have personally collected an Oscar, but I think that, you know, there is a lot of resentment towards Harvey and Hollywood, and that certainly may have played a role.
What do you think the breakup of Disney and Pixar and of Michael Eisner, how does that play into Miramax?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting question, Richard. I think that one way that scenario plays out, that now that Disney has lost Pixar, you know, Harvey will be bolder, demand more concessions. My guess is he'll get them. I still, despite all the Sturm und Drang between Miramax and Disney, I just don't see Miramax leaving.
Peter Biskin, something you said earlier on about the organizing factor of Easy Rider's Raging Bulls, the difference between that and Down and Dirty Pictures is that Down and Dirty Pictures is more of a chronological tale. You do focus on Weinstein, you do focus on Redford and Sundance, and to a lesser degree on October Films. You avoid companies like Fine Line, Fox Searchlight, except as kind of rivals, and there's five or six of these smaller companies. Lionsgate is a very important independent film company that you really don't talk about because it's Canadian, and I'm just curious why you sort of avoided that.
For example, Searchlight was really a negligible factor when I started the book. They've been having a couple of very good years subsequently. Fine Line did a couple of good films, but nevertheless was nowhere near a power like Miramax. Lionsgate, you know, I thought about Lionsgate a couple of times, but I just didn't have room. One of the people I was kind of following was this guy, Amir Malin, who starts with Cinecom in the 80s, goes to October, and then started a company called Artisan, which had this huge hit in the Blair Witch Project. I had, 100 pages on Artisan and Blair Witch, which I had to cut out because I didn't have room. And essentially, I just didn't have room to do everything. You know, you asked earlier about why certain things got left out of Easy Rider's Raging Bulls. You know, you think when you're starting a book that, you know, a book is so expansive and you're used to writing magazine articles that you think you'll have room for everything, but you'd be surprised at how fast you fill the book up. I just didn't have room.
Peter Biskind, there's another company which is not an indie. It kind of sits outside all of this because, hey, everything shows up on television, or most of it does. And I want you to talk a little about it in relation to independent film and whether there is any synergy between independent film, and that's HBO, because the best movie last year, 2003, was an HBO film, Angels in America.
Right. Well, you know, I watch HBO a lot because I live upstate New York, and we've been having these horrible winters, and, you know, it sounds like an ad for HBO, but I could, you know, HBO saved me last winter from going like completely crazy with Cabin Fever. I think HBO is to the networks as the independents are to Hollywood. Essentially, they have been making, they do make the most interesting television, and now they're getting into film production, and which I think is a good thing, because somebody over there, you know, has really good instincts, and, you know, the more financial entities producing good films, the better, as far as I'm concerned.
A lot of people would argue that it was not a mistake, and I wonder if it was for HBO not to take Angels in America and do something unusual and release the two-part film in theaters before putting it on TV.
Well, I think they could be more aggressive doing that. I mean, there are conventions, you know, and conventional wisdom that dictate, you know, that if a film has appeared on HBO, it doesn't then go into the theaters. But October took a film called The Last Seduction, which had played on cable. I don't know if it was HBO or Showtime or one of the other cable channels, bought the film and had a very successful theatrical run with it.
Well, actually, that happened even before with The Great Santini, which showed up as The Ace on HBO before going to theaters.
Yeah, well, I didn't know that, but if that's true, then
it is.
Yeah, I believe you. Can I interrupt for a second?
Sure.
You know, you were asking about the differences between Easy Rider's Raging Bulls and Down and Dirty Pictures, and, you know, when I started to do Down and Dirty Pictures, I realized that I couldn't go from auteur to auteur the way I did in Easy Riders, because these filmmakers were much younger. A lot of them were in mid-career. Some of them were just starting their careers, like Alexander Payne had only released one movie, Citizen Ruth. So I couldn't treat them like filmmakers that had 15, 20 films under their belts. And I felt that, you know, one of the big stories of this decade was in a way a business or a marketing story, which was the Miramax story. So that is really the reason for the difference, the major difference in the structure of the books.
You're listening to an interview with Peter Biskind, whose latest book is Down and Dirty Pictures. You bring up several movies. First off, I notice that you're very blunt in your own opinions about films, which is almost startling because you stay out of the way in your opinions of people.
a bit. I'm a film critic, Monk Hay. I used to write film criticism. I do have strong opinions about films. I wanted, as far as the people goes, I wanted them to speak for themselves, or I wanted the way the people were portrayed to more or less speak for themselves. And since I, at least, intended all these people to have to I displayed a mixture. I tried to of both good and bad. And positive and negative, I wanted the readers to draw their own conclusions, and I think people did draw different conclusions about different people in the book. The films, I just didn't feel any reason not to not mince words about them.
A film that came out, I think it was 1980, was Reds, and they have said since that a movie, a big epic about the Russian Revolution, could never be made today. However, a couple of years ago, an incredibly political film, very critical of America, came out, of the United States government, came out, called Three Kings, maybe one of the best films of the past 10 years, unrecognized, in my opinion, maybe yours also. Is it possible that a film like Reds could be made and that those pundits are wrong?
I think it's unlikely. I mean, I agree that, I mean, the only reason Reds got made in 1980 was because the producer was a huge movie star. I mean, if you had come along, if a producer who was not a movie star had come along, or a screenwriter had come along with that script, they would have just told him to get lost. I mean, it wasn't easy for Beatty to get Reds made. It was very difficult. Three Kings, I agree with you, is one of the best films of the decade, and one of the regrets I have about the book is I didn't go into the making of Three Kings in greater detail. I just mentioned the film a couple of times. But it is an example of an independent filmmaker making a film within the studio system at a studio which is one of the most conservative studios, known largely for blockbusters and sequels of blockbusters, and had his way and managed to preserve his vision and make a film extremely critical of American foreign policy and the American political process. And it's really remarkable, and I think is a fluke. I think it would be very hard to replicate that, possible, but difficult. And one of the reasons, I think, I just asked David Russell that the other day, and he said one of the reasons he got away with it was because it was a thriller, it was a genre film, a war film. You know, and you can disguise a lot of things in working in a genre film.
Peter Biskind, just as the period of the 70s came to a close and movies in the 80s and 90s, it became clear that nobody was going to make movies like Deer Hunter or Apocalypse Now or Reds for quite a while. It seems that the ending of Down and Dirty Pictures, with Miramax turning its eye to films like Cold Mountain, and with politics perhaps beginning to get in the way, though you never really go into that, and I do want to ask you about whether there's a change there. Have we seen the last of the great explosion of independent films, lost in translation notwithstanding?
No, I don't think so, actually. I think that there's a similarity and a big difference in the way this decade ended. I think when I started the book, I wasn't sure how I was going to end it, because it seemed like the 90s was still going on. Even after the new millennium, but it became clear after a couple of years of working on the book, that Miramax was getting out of the independent game, and was moving more and more towards the close to the Cold Mountains, and that did give the decade a bit of closure. The major difference is that Miramax, precisely because moved out of the independent game, it's allowed breathing space for a lot of new companies that are coming up, both independent divisions of studios like Focus Features, James Shamus and David Lindy at Universal, Warner Brothers New, Warner's Independent, run by Mark Gill. Some of the other divisions like Fox Searchlight are doing very well. Sony Classics, which has been around for a long time, continues to do well. And then there are the so-called, quote-unquote, real independents, like Lionsgate, like New Market, that are doing very well. Plus, the digital video revolution is allowing a lot of young filmmakers to get their hands on cameras and shoot very, very low-budget films. I mean, more or less fulfilling the Francis Coppola's observation in the early 70s that the revolution in technology was going to enable the fabled little old lady in Columbus, Ohio, in her garage to make her own small film.
On the other hand, suddenly we're seeing It may not be as part of the festival, but we are seeing things like Butterfly Effect, which is clearly Hollywood product, popping up at places like Sundance.
Since I'm not the person who programs that festival, I think you'd have to ask Jeff Gilmore that question. But I do think, and I do make the argument in the book, that Sundance has become more and more commercial. I mean, I'm not certainly not the first person to say that, but I think the change happened in the mid-90s when you had suddenly an enormous competition among the independent distributors for acquisitions, and films that normally you could have acquired for a couple hundred thousand dollars were suddenly costing $1 million, $2 million, even $10 million. And the festival became more of a market than a festival, which is to say the attention was devoted to what films were selling for as opposed to who were the hot young filmmakers and with the real talent.
Well, Peter Biskin, the other part of my question, let me throw that at you. We've seen CBS cave in several times in the past few months regarding the right wing. There's a lot of fear of what will happen to this country after November if George W. Bush gets reelected. Thus far, it appears in Down and Dirty Pictures that really has not affected Hollywood. Certainly someone like Weinstein, who's a solid Democrat, is not necessarily going to gear his films toward the right wing. But are we seeing any kind of censorship? Are we seeing any silencing as the Bush administration continues?
Well, I think one phenomenon which predates the Bush administration is that once these independent companies become parts of big media conglomerates, they become more prone to censorship or more subject to censorship than when they're independent. For example, and there are a couple of, you know, fairly well-known instances of that in the 90s, you know, Miramax, even though Harvey himself is a Democrat with a capital D and his own instincts are pretty good politically, I think. He picked up a couple films in 1995, Priest and Kids, which created an enormous embarrassment for Disney, and then Dogma a couple of years later, directed by Kevin Smith. Harvey had to get rid of the film and give it to Lionsgate because Disney just didn't want to take the heat. And the pressure groups are really after the parent companies, Disney, but that makes the indie divisions even more sensitive. And another well-known incident of that nature happened with Todd Solondz's Happiness at Universal. Universal was at that point owned by Seagram's, and, you know, October was distributing the film and was told outright it's bad for the stockholders.
There's also the idea of taking a film to audiences, letting them do cards, and changing the film. And we've seen, you know, the most famous example, of course, Fatal Attraction. But apparently Harvey Scissorhands, as he's called, has done his own dirty work on several films. There's a certain form of censorship there, and I'm curious about that continuing and growing as these other independent studios get larger, and also how that plays into the fact that every Hollywood film from a major studio seems these days to be totally inconsistent and pat in its morality, and it has to, I don't know, have a moral and all that garbage.
Well, you know, when you're dealing with Hollywood films, it's really like the old, the conventions that used to get, you know, used to and still probably get, govern the network televisions. It's the lowest common denominator. You're making films that cost $80, $90 million. You're going to eliminate anything that might antagonize any segment of the audience, and consequently, you've got a total blanding out of the film. Independent films, almost by definition, in the beginning, were never tested. I mean, by nature, they're supposed to be idiosyncratic personal visions. How can you test those, you know? And they were never tested. Now, Miramax started previewing and running films in front of test audiences almost immediately in the early 90s, and it became more and more intense as the decade wore on, and people felt that Harvey became addicted to test scores and changing films to raise the numbers. And sometimes, you know, he was accused of purposely showing films to inappropriate audiences in order to use low test scores as arguments against the filmmaker to allow him to change the movies. And certainly, some directors don't mind testing. I think most directors feel they can learn something from sitting in a theater with an audience. I think what they object to is the quantifying of the testing. You know, like Quentin Tarantino never allowed cards and still doesn't. And I think a lot of directors feel that way, but the pressure to test is enormous, and again, it gets back to, you know, a lot of these directors have Final Cut at Miramax and other studios or independents, but Final Cut means nothing if the distributor tells you, as Miramax often does, well, I don't care if you have Final Cut. If you don't change your movie the way I'm telling you to, well, I'm just not going to be very enthusiastic about distributing it.
And that kills the film.
So you're faced as a director with a Hobson's choice or Sophie's choice between, cutting your own work or seeing it die or go straight to video.
To some degree, that's sort of what happened to Citizen Ruth, though Citizen Ruth survived as a great movie.
Yes, it did survive as a great movie, but yes, I mean, the filmmakers felt that, that it got a very perfunctory distribution campaign. And a lot of filmmakers, if Miramax loves your movie, there's probably not a better distributor. If they don't love your movie, then, you can just kiss it goodbye.
Peter Biskind, when you are reporting and trying to stay away from gossip, per se, and you stumble on an affair, and you stumble on a gay actor, how do you deal with it? Do you just, protect them?
It depends. It depends on what kind of piece you're writing, who you're writing for, what kind of book you're writing. In the 70s book, Easy Riders, I did get into people's personal lives because the culture they lived in and worked in was so much a part of the story. And plus, this was an era of personal filmmaking. My feeling was that somebody like Scorsese, who made a film like Mean Streets out of his life, essentially, you couldn't really understand these films without understanding people's personal lives. And you certainly couldn't understand what happened to these filmmakers, why so many of them burned out, without understanding the drug culture. The people who I interviewed who lived through that decade, for the most part, were pretty free and open about talking about drugs. It was a subject that was, 30 years old. Even at the time, they were pretty open about it. In the 90s book, I felt that people's personal lives were less relevant. The filmmakers were not larger than life the way the 70s filmmakers were. I don't think people really cared about, Soderbergh's personal life, for example. And Harvey Weinstein is a distributor, not a filmmaker. And as far as I can make out, his personal peccadilloes, whatever they are, if there are any, had very little to do with his business. So I didn't feel it was justified. And in the Weinstein case, I sort of felt that his business practices were as bizarre as any of the sex, drugs, and rock and roll of the 70s book. So I didn't really need to go into people's personal lives. And, you don't want to gratuitously hurt people. Even in the 70s book, I found out things about minor characters that would have been hurtful, would have been interesting, but would have been hurtful, and I didn't use them because there wasn't any real reason to hurt someone for no reason. People were bystanders in these events, and why drag them through the mud,
But there's also your work with Vanity Fair and your earlier work with Premiere. How did you deal with those issues then, particularly with Premiere?
Well, when Premiere started, it's an interesting question because when Premiere started, we never went into people's personal lives. The articles were always about the films, or about their professional lives. But as Premiere evolved and started to get competition from things like Entertainment Weekly, and then people started taking the tabloids a lot more seriously, you did find more personal material working into those articles. But even so, Premiere is a magazine which is a single subject magazine. Consequently, it's very much a creature of the industry that it reports on, which means that you're under a really tight rein from the publicist so that you get punished for including personal material or anything that you can. I did write a piece for Vanity Fair about Terry Malick, who is an extremely private person, and I actually went to Paris to interview one of his ex-wives. I have second thoughts about that piece to some degree. I think it turned out, interestingly, I certainly discovered personal things about Terry Malick that had never been reported before and probably will never be reported again. But, I'm not sure that it was justified in that instance.
How about political viewpoints, or is that just an open topic, you think?
That's an open topic. I don't think there's a real taboo against it. I just did a piece for Vanity Fair on Russell Crowe, and I asked him about politics because I noticed reading his clips that he'd never commented about politics, and he's a guy who has a lot of opinions about everything. And he was very, very nervous about talking about his politics. I think he felt that coming out sort of politically would hurt him at the box office, that if he was known as a Democrat, or a liberal like Tim Robbins, and was identified with a particular point of view, it would hurt his acting somehow, or hurt it would interfere with the way people perceived him in his roles. And he was very, very reluctant to talk about it.
Will we ever see a major gay star?
You know, well, I think we'll find out in the next couple, you know, in this next election. You know, it depends on how much of an issue that the Republicans make of same-sex marriage, you know, how that goes down with the electorate. I think certainly it seems like things are loosening up. I mean, Angels in America, I mean, you know, you just name all the gay theme shows. I think the way things are going now, unless there's a major backlash, I think we will.
Peter Biskin, a couple of final questions about the future of film. First is a small question, screeners. Screeners are the DVDs or the tapes that people get at the end of the year so they can make awards decisions. And they were banned, and then they came back as tapes, mostly because independent films can't get seen otherwise. This means, if they're banned, that the entire distribution year will change. And if they're not banned, what happens?
Well, I actually don't think it's such a small question, because screeners are very, very important for independent marketing, for marketing of independent films. And I think, from my point of view, the screener flap showed two contradictory things. On the one hand, the studios made this decision to ban screeners without taking the independents and even their own independent divisions into consideration in the least, which I think indicates how, in some sense, financially inconsequential the independent business is to the studios. On the other hand, and contrarily, I think they were completely taken aback by the outcry the independents whipped up, which really made them back off. And I think that suggests that the independents have a real presence in the marketplace and in the minds and, you know, screens of people who really like and love movies. So I think that was a real reality check for the studios. I think if the screener ban is reinstituted, it is going to be a disaster for, I think it means that a lot of these films will have to open much earlier in the year so they get out on video, on tape or DVD earlier than they are. And that's already happening because of the truncated. I mean, Harvey Weinstein suggested that one of the reasons Cold Mountain wasn't nominated was because it was released too late, and that combination of that and the Oscars being moved up didn't really allow time for the Miramax publicity machine to get into high gear.
When they moved it up by a month, did the people who moved it up, did the Academy understand the vast financial and, in fact, artistic implications of a move like that?
I doubt it. I think they were just trying to, you know, compete with the Golden Globes more effectively. You know, I'm not sure what was in their minds. You know, they were trying. You know, they're always voicing unhappiness with all the hype. And I suppose the shorter the season, the less hype, the fewer ads, so forth and so on. So I guess it was an attempt to kind of put a lid on the sort of out of control, which is again a kind of backhanded slap at Miramax.
The other bigger question is the future of film in many areas. There was a quote regarding a film called Last Samurai, which, of course, is a big epic from a major studio, that even though it did not quite as well as they hoped it would, it did cross $100 million, which is fast becoming easier to do with increased ticket prices. But a studio executive said, and I don't know if this is hype or not, that it doesn't really matter because the exploding sales of DVDs will more than make up for that loss.
No, I think that's true. I mean, the DVD market, it's like the video explosion in the early 80s now. I mean, films are making more money through DVD sales than they are in the theaters. And the theaters, in the case of many films, the theatrical exhibition or the theatrical run of a film is just a loss leader. It's an extensive trailer for the DVD, and I certainly think a film like The Last Samurai, especially, you know, with the explosion of large screen TVs, I mean, that's a film that it's crying to be shown on a big screen. That will do extremely well on DVD. There are many ways to skin a whatever. You know, they cut a film, they release their version, then they come back and make money off the director's cut. You know, it's a riot because, you know, they can't lose.
Peter Biskin, projecting 10 years down the road, what will we be looking at in terms of film?
Well, you know, prognosticating 10 years down the road in the movie business is, you know, it's just asking to be made a fool of, but never one to shrink from making a fool of myself. You know, I certainly think that we're going to see a lot more of these so-called indie water hybrid films like Lost in Translation, which are kind of midway between the traditional independent film and the Hollywood film, with a big Hollywood star like Bill Murray, yet, you know, in a vehicle which very little plot, which is one of the independent characteristics, and no happy ending, and not much happens. It's a character-driven and a script-driven film. I think there'll be a lot more of those. Like Monstered, Charlize Theron's wonderful movie is a, and Patty Jenkins' wonderful movie is an example of that. And I think more of the, seeing more of those films is all to the good. Medium budget films that have a more commercial value than the traditional independent film, but nevertheless are still in essence independent films. Coming up from the bottom, again, we're going to see a lot of young filmmakers making cheap films on DV. And then last part of that puzzle is new methods of distribution, films that come right to the audiences bypassing theaters, the traditional ways, means of exhibition, either video on demand, the internet, you know, the usual. And I think we have a window of maybe 5 or 10 years before Murdoch buys up all of those pipelines and we're back to where we started.
There's also the possibility that you present kind of offhand in Down and Dirty Pictures, but I think it's more than that. With theatrical distribution becomes less a way of making money and more a way of promoting a film.
No, I think that's true. Again, with the increase in these home theaters and people who go to the movies, baby, you know, it's certainly easier to sit in your den with an 82-inch flat-screen TV and watch a movie on high-quality movie on high-definition TV or DVD than to schlep out to your movie theater, get a babysitter, find a parking space, and then pay $15 for a ticket, which undoubtedly they'll cost in 10 years, if not 2 years.
It creates this bizarre dichotomy. How do you promote a film to adults if adults don't go to theaters and the only ones who go to theaters are teenagers?
Well, it does, and it also indicates, it pushes the buttons of the worst parts of Hollywood, which is catering to that teenage audience, doing those comic book films, which we all love to hate.
Peter Biskin, what are you working on now?
I'm doing a biography of Warren Beatty is my next book, which is something I've wanted to do for a long time, and since you mentioned Reds, it's something I'm really looking forward to.
You've been listening to an interview with Peter Biskin, whose most recent book is Down and Dirty Pictures, Miramax, Sundance, and the Rise of Independent Film. It's very, very enjoyable. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.